All right, Film Study with Ken McCusick, week 14, where we get to talk about the big test for the Ravens. We all know this team was built defensively to beat the Steelers, and it's what they focused all their offseason focus on. Then they lost last night 38-39, so we've got to break down that defense and talk about it. Ken McCusick, how are you doing?
Life's good, Josh. How about you?
I'm doing all right. I hate staying up past midnight for a loss. It's never fun.
Yeah, you know, it's a tough night for us, too, because we're up all night then analyzing the game after, and it's a long night.
I you know what? I can't imagine having to watch that game again.
And it's an emotionally draining game to watch, wasn't it?
It was a surprising game because finally the offense stepped up. Finally the offense did their part. And we've got a defense that we've been wondering, how good is this defense all season? And apparently they can't stop the Steelers.
Well, it is one game. I'll start with that. But a disappointing game at that. A lot of things didn't go right. But a couple things went right, and we'll talk about that as well. So let's get right into it.
Yeah, let's get into it. And let's just jump straight in. We can talk about the playoffs. You want to cover the playoffs now at the top or and where we stand, or you want to do that at the end?
We can talk about it right now briefly.
All right, a little bit of positive to start the show.
Yeah, the easiest way to talk about it is the Ravens need to win their next three games. And it's not the only way they can get in, but it's the only automatic way they can get in. So if they win their three games, I have not been through every permutation of multiple tiebreakers, but I believe they are in if they win all three against either the Bills or against the Chargers. But there could be a potential problem if there's a fall from grace for one of the AFC South teams. So anyway, they need to avoid multi-ways, but at 10-6, they're likely in. And the Cleveland game is, by the way, there'll be an article about that tomorrow online. The Cleveland game in particular is a critical one. They need it for a couple reasons, but they need it because it's one of the three. And you know that Cleveland would love nothing better than to beat the Ravens. Their fans right. hate us. Their team probably doesn't care nearly as much, or even their management, but their fans certainly hate us.
And you got to get up, and if you can get up and get excited for that game by a chance to keep a division rival out of the playoffs, that's something to get excited for.
There you go. But they do win any two-way tiebreaker with Buffalo. They win any two-way tiebreaker with the Chargers now. Those are now locked in. The Buffalo, based on common opponents. The Chargers, based on conference record. The Jets are out of the playoff pictures at this point, which is kind of nice. The Bengals were out last week, so that's kind of nice. So a few things fell into place that make it at least not as many competitors in the field. And the main issue the Ravens have is the multi-way tiebreakers. And there is another big one they can lose. They can lose a tiebreaker to the Chiefs, which is probably the biggest single fear, is that them and the Chiefs both finish 9-7, and that's the only head-to-head tiebreaker that the Ravens can lose.
Right. Now this was a big loss because the Steelers beat us twice this year, both games. Now we find ourselves fighting for this playoff spot to try to get a third attempt against the Steelers this year.
Yeah, that's right.
So what was walking away from that? What's the worst part of that? Is it because we're losing to the Steelers? Is it how it affects the playoffs? Or is it just the fact that our offense jumped up to a big lead and couldn't hold it?
Yeah, it's disappointing to see the defense lose a lead. Now, the defense, it's unfair to say the defense loses a lead every time. Of course, as we've talked about on this show, the Ravens have only blown one lead at any point during a game of 3 points or more. It's a three-point lead at Minnesota. Otherwise, they have not had a single lead the entire season that they've blown until this game. And then, of course, this game, they led by 11. They led by 11 fairly late and still found a way to lose it.
Right.
And it's not the game you want to lose in that way, obviously.
Sure. Let's get into the pass rush, because Roethlisberger had 500 passing yards, right, yesterday?
Yeah, so he had 506 and net of 486.
Right.
Take out the 20 yards of sacks. So
and then
yes.
all the time in the world in the pocket, it appeared.
It certainly seemed that way. So he had, in actuality, he had 34 out of 67 ATS attempts. First of all, is anybody upset that Roethlisberger is allowed to throw the ball 67 times in one game, 67 dropbacks? 66 passes, you take out two spikes, you're at 64. You add back in three sacks, you're at 67. That's how we're there. 34 of those were ATS. Now, that's not really an unusual number. That's right around the 50% number we might expect. But then when you add to that the fact that he had the ball out quickly another 17 times, it really was only 16 times the Ravens generated a pressure against him, and that's quite bad. If you look at the other things that are really bad about this, it's really bad to not have any turnovers. Now, the trailing team throws a lot, and they usually are trading additional turnovers for yards. And so you really hope that a team is not able to just drop back in the pocket at will, eat a sandwich basically on every down, and throw for 500 yards in a game. But that's what the Steelers basically were able to do against the Ravens.
Right, and the Steelers came into the game clearly with the game plan of throwing the ball and taking advantage of us not having Jimmy Smith.
That's right. I mean, we had Brandon Carr on the field before last time, but they did throw 12 times at Humphrey. And I guess when you throw 67 times, you're going to throw a few times at every cornerback.
Right.
But they threw 12 times at Humphrey and had absolutely no success. He was 6 of 12 for 37 yards, I believe, on that side. Might have been 57, but anyway, a very low total. And he did his job and shut down the opponent. Unfortunately, it was all Brandon Carr on the other side who had a lot of difficulty. They had a lot of difficulty over the middle of the field, in particular the inside linebackers covering people. Mosley was targeted 14 or 15 times with 11 receptions. So, a combination of bad things happening in the middle of the field and on the right sideline with Antonio Brown was really the problem.
Right. How much did not having Za'Darius Smith hurt this pass rush?
Oh, it's huge. I'm glad you brought that up, Josh, because Za'Darius Smith had 9 quarterback hits in the previous 4 games, I believe it was, and only one of those was a sack, but he had been part of turnovers by getting quarterback hits, and that was very big. It was a big part of the Ravens' pass rush. And it hurt them more in this game because he wasn't able to play those inside pass rush snaps, and they had to have sometimes extra defensive alignment on the field, which just isn't as good. So they had Brandon Williams a lot out there trying to generate pressure on passing downs. And then at the very end, they decided, okay, we can't do that anymore, and they put Matthew Judon on the inside, and he didn't really play that well either in this game. So he only had one pressure event the whole game that I could see as a quarterback hit, and it came kind of late. So, it's one of these things where they could not find the right formula without a very key member of their pass rushing core, and I think it kind of underscores his value going forward that Za'Darius Smith will be a fourth-year player next year, and they're going to have to kind of decide what they want to do with him.
And what is Za'Darius Smith's status right now?
Well, he'll be a tendered free RFA. I'm sorry, he's a drafted player. So he's already signed for next year.
All right. No, but I mean, is he done for the year?
No. He had a shoulder, not that I'm aware of anyway. He had a shoulder injury, and if something came out today, I missed it. But he was a scratch for this game.
Okay. All right. So hopefully we'll have him back for these final three, and then hopefully the playoff push.
Yep.
How about halftime? The first half, the defense was just getting ran over and could not force a change of possession.
That's
immediately
right.
To start the second half, we all know it's a big drive to try to keep it as a 3-point game, and they get a 3-and-out with the Steelers. Did they change something with the way they attacked?
Yeah, very different pressure scheme in the second half. So you mentioned it exactly. They had 4 drives. Weren't stopped. They were only stopped by the half ending, really, on the 4th drive, and they kicked that field goal. But they only had one time where they were stopped on downs, and they kicked the field goal in the first half. And then they had, of course, had the 2 touchdowns as well, and rolling up 20 points in 4 possessions. The first 3 stops of that second half, first 3 drives, they were stopped in 5 plays or less, 5, 3, and 3 in terms of stopping them on downs. On plays, I should say. And so that was great. It was a great turnaround. It was largely driven by increased pressure. So Pease didn't do a whole lot of scheming for pressure in the first half. I remember the sideline reporter, I think, said, John Harbaugh said, we have a lot of blitzes coming to the second half. And that sounded to me like garbagey coach speak. But they really opened up the blitz playbook in the second half with all kinds of different pressures. They had for the game, they had 14 deceptive pressures in this game. It was a lot of passes, so 67 dropbacks.
Right.
But you know, you've heard these numbers week to week. We're having two or we're having four, but 14 is a lot. They had 18 individual blitzes from off the line of scrimmage. So that's also a very high number for P's. And they had eight stunts, and we haven't seen much stunting from this team at all. So a very deceptive array of pass rushes, most in the second half. And they were more effective rushing the passer in the second half. Clearly, they got it down to 50% and even got some pressure on that final drive, but they just were not – the defense was so gassed in the secondary and unable to keep it covered that the ball was out quickly a lot, and they weren't able to do much in terms of stopping them anyway. So difficult game. You know, once a game starts to get away from you in terms of the number of plays, which has often been a problem for the Ravens against the Steelers, is the Steelers seem to have many more plays from scrimmage and are able to stay on the field more. In this game, the Steelers went 12 for 18 on third down. So right there, that should tell you they were on the field an awful lot more than we would have liked.
Sure. 67 pass attempts, 500 yards. How do we look at this game as a Ravens organization? How does this game, is this the worst passing we've given up as an organization?
Well, it's actually very close to another game in Ravens history. So maybe we take a little sidebar and talk about that for a second, because I brought it up in the article.
All right.
So on Christmas Eve 2000, the Ravens played a game against the Jets, and it was a game that really was a reversal of a lot of things that happened in that season because they were so successful, of course. But Vinny Testaverde dropped back 69 times, threw for 481 net yards, which seems an awful lot like 67 for 486. There was just one little difference, is the Ravens really punished the Jets that day by forcing six turnovers, three interceptions that were returned for 183 yards, and another three fumbles. So they didn't get away with the loosey-goosey ball strategy. They were punished for it, and that's what they ought to. The Ravens also had two punt returns from Jermaine Lewis in that game for touchdowns, and they won 34-20 despite having only five first downs. So it's very vivid in my memory. I've watched this game a number of times over the years, but I did also put it in my article and have a link to it in the from there that you can go take a look at that if you're maybe too young to remember the game, or maybe you just don't remember it all. It's been a long time. But the thing that comes to mind about it is that the teams that the Ravens faced in the playoffs really thought that game against the Jets is the Achilles heel for this Ravens defense. We finally found it. All you have to do is play the spread offense, and they can't stop us. Well, three teams tried to do that in the playoffs, and they scored a total of six offensive points against the Ravens. It was Denver, Oakland, and the New York Giants. And in so doing, they just all failed miserably at it, and the Ravens shut them down in the playoffs. So what I'm saying is, I don't think this game has to define the 2017 Ravens either in terms of whether or not they're a good playoff team.
I hear that. The differences would be in 2000, that was Vinny Testaverde throwing the ball, so you got those six turnovers. Here you're going against Ben Roethlisberger, who's a Hall of Fame quarterback. My hesitation keeps being that this team, the whole reason we draft on defense, is to beat the Steelers.
Mm-hmm.
And it has not worked this year. Is that a concern, or is it that the Steelers have Ben, Bell, and Brown? They've got the three Bs, as they kept pushing on primetime football. Is it just that they've got the best current squad playing football today?
They have certainly a very impressive set of offensive weapons, and Juju was not active for this game, so he'll be back, and you know, is a very fine receiver also. So I think you've got to look at it by component. And the Ravens, what they did do very well in this game that they didn't do well in the first game was shut down Bell. So you can start with that in terms of how they did it on the ground, because having Brandon Williams back really did lead to a shutdown of Bell. How the other way they needed to shut down Bell was in the air. And the strategy of putting Jefferson on him, I really like. I think it was the right strategy to try. I think other players would have had a harder time covering him. Jefferson did get one great hit on him on the right sideline, so that was a nice put him out of the game for a few plays move. But he also had some trouble covering and seemed to be a little bit tentative, honestly, covering Bell, where I think you need to get right up on top of him and see what you can do in terms of trying to deny him the football. Mosley did do a good job in the end zone covering Bell on one play. That was one that I looked at and I said, okay, this is one good play from C.J. Mosley, because very difficult game for him otherwise. He had a lot of trouble covering. Did not really have a bunch of impact plays in the run game. I have not seen him make an impact play in the passing game as a rusher in some time either. So CJ is looks like he's playing hurt, and it looks like he's slower than he has been at other times.
That's struggle, and that's tough to see. Was this was the third loss in a row to the Steelers? Is that correct?
Yeah, so
we lost last December.
Mm-hmm.
Right, was that a Christmas we lost?
So that was the Christmas game, but that has some similarities to this game as well. So maybe we should talk about that. The Ravens last year, that was the game where Kyle Juszczyk broke through with a minute and 18 left and scored a touchdown. So it's 3rd and 1 from the 10-yard line. He got through the line of scrimmage, and all of a sudden the Steelers lost interest in trying to stop him, including Bud Dupree, who kind of just like almost stood up on the play. And Juszczyk then had burst through already and then was able to regain his footing and get to the goal line and dive in. Well, the fact of the matter was the Steelers wanted the football back at that point, and the Ravens would have done well had they been prepared in the huddle to know that nobody should score. If you break through, you go to the 1-yard line and we'll take it from there, kind of thing. Well, the Ravens had a similar point in this game. And it was at 3rd and 3, and maybe it was even at 4th and 3, but I'm going to start at 3rd and 3 on their last drive before the Steelers scored the field goal to go ahead. So they led 38-36 at that point, I guess it was. Yeah, that sounds right, 38-36. Yep. And they had the ball, 3rd and 3, and I don't have the exact line yard line, but in the 20s or in the low 30s, might have been the 32. And instead of running, consuming a little more clock, and giving themselves a reasonable chance to get the first down there, but more importantly, giving themselves a good chance to get it in two tries, they went ahead and they threw the football, were incomplete, and they were left with 4th and 3. Now, even in that situation, I think that was one where I was already at the point going into the drive that the Ravens offense needed to control the ball somehow for about 8 plays. Get 2 first downs, have 8 plays, and they would probably have been able to run out the clock or run it far enough down that the Steelers wouldn't have had any chance to do anything.
Right, because like there was still 3.5 minutes or something at that point.
Right. I'll take your word for it. I will look really
quickly. I think that's about what it was when we gave the ball back to the Steelers, a little more than 3 minutes.
Okay, I'm going to look, because
my memory,
2 and change.
I don't know, because my memory was that it was
2:25.
2:25, all right. So yeah, it was closer to forcing them to use some timeouts.
Right. So it's 4th and 3 at 2:34 left. That would have been the 4th play of the drive.
Okay.
They had 3 timeouts left, so they really needed to probably control it for at least another 5 plays to run all the Steelers' timeouts off and then run it far enough down with a punt that they wouldn't have had a chance to do anything more with it. But anyway, they had passed already once. That might have extended the number of plays by once. But on 4th and 3, they were faced with a very similar situation to Belichick a few years ago against the Colts. And he didn't have any fear and went ahead and went for it on 4th and 3. And you could say, oh, he had Tom Brady and this and that. But the fact of the matter is, he went for it on 4th and 3 because it was the right decision mathematically to make. This would have been a very close one in terms of what's the correct decision mathematically to go for it on 4th and 3 or not. But I think the circumstances being what they were in terms of the Ravens' inability to stop them at all just looked too similar to last Christmas to me, after they'd had a, let's see, 8-play, 68-yard drive for a touchdown. In the previous drive, they'd had a 5-play, 67-yard drive for a touchdown. The Christmas of last year had been 2 straight drives, I think it's 75-5 and 90-6. So they were both 15-yard-per-play drives, I recall. And It just looked too similar in terms of the Ravens' inability to stop them. And it's very hard to stop 4-down football, period. It's incredibly hard to do it if you can't get turnovers or generate a ton of pressure. And the Ravens just were not doing either of those things in this game, and it was not a good situation for them to really put the football back in Ben's hands, it would have been a better chance to take to go for the first down there.
Yeah, I can see that looking back. It's it makes a lot of sense when you think about how winded that defense was at the end. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the fact of knowing that our offense is going to need to score more points, so let the Steelers get their points right away to give us some more time on the clock, because we're going to have to do something.
You know, that was the other thing.
If it fails.
You're speaking about the redraw value. So they fail on fourth and three. You're actually not playing four-down football anymore. You're only playing three-down football, which is an enormous difference.
Right.
Then you have to get them off the field in three plays. Maybe you can give up one first down on the first play, but you have to get them off the field and have a stop almost immediately. But you only have to stop them on three plays, as they were able to do when they got the Steelers into position. But that defense was just not ready for an extended drive. They weren't ready to do it, and you know, they ended up on the field for 83 snaps for the game, 83 that counted. Two spikes were in there, and I'm taking out the penalties, which you could add more for. But anyway, 83 snaps in the game is a lot, and it's more than this defense was really ready to do. Brandon Williams on the field for 59 snaps. Willie Henry on the field for 57 snaps. They were requiring these guys who were completely gassed to try and get in there and get some pass rush ability. And it just wasn't happening. Suggs was winded as anything. He had 63 snaps on the game. So, boy, just a tough game for these guys to have to stay on the field.
Yeah, and I hate to look back at games like that, but it does make you wonder, what if they trusted the offense a little more and admitted that the offense was going to need to win this game, not the defense?
Right. I mean, I think sometimes you got to come to that realization on a game-by-game basis, even if that's not your normal opinion of it.
Right.
Even if you say, well, this is the 2017 Ravens defense. They pitched three shutouts this year. They're good. Well, okay, they are good under normal circumstances, but they've given up two touchdown drives in a row, and they've been on the field forever. The fourth quarter, they had an unbelievable number of plays. You know, it's time to just let the offense try and win the game here.
Right. It's Joe. We paid Joe all this money. Let's let him try to do it.
And that would be my reason, but that would be a reason. That would be something you could say.
It's way easier to say this today than in the moment.
Actually, if you go out and look on my Twitter, it's there.
Okay.
In the moment.
All right. Well, you had it there in the moment.
Yeah.
Let's talk about a few of these players, and I want to start with Marlon Humphrey, because there was a lot of talk going into this game of we're in a huge problem because Marlon Humphrey is not Jimmy Smith. He's struggled. He's a rookie. We're putting a rookie up against the Browns. But he seemed to have a great game.
He did, and he was definitely one of the Ravens' stars defensively, probably their biggest star defensively, I think of one other. But first start, they threw at him 12 times, completed half of those. I forget if it was 37 or 57 yards, but it doesn't matter. It's a low total. The big opportunity they had, and the Ravens had three good opportunities to get an interception yesterday. So one of them was on a ball that went off Humphrey's hands and then helmet while he was guarding on the left sideline.
Right.
So that would have been one of the plays. Any one of those, the Ravens get them, they don't lose this game in all likelihood. But that's often the case in one-point games.
Yeah, it's that. It's the Suggs interception attempt.
The Suggs
interception. And Flacco throwing interception. You take any of those away, and they won.
That's certainly true. And Levine's pass defense, I thought, you know, was a play that you could get an interception
when that's knocked
also
in the air. Yep.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to the other side of the field with Brandon Carr. Now, was he having a really bad game, or is Antonio Brown just the best wide receiver in football?
You know, I think I actually do probably blame most of it on Brown and not on Carr. Carr got pushed off twice for OPIs that didn't get called. And if they're going to call the game that way, it just tremendously benefits the Steelers receivers.
Right.
I mean, they're able to do that. And Brown, in particular, separates with his hands. And it's just not anything you do about it. I almost think it would have been better on some of those plays if Carr had just fallen down when he was pushed. It's just like, go take a dive. You can't cover this guy.
Right,
but,
sure.
But, you know, go take a dive. But anyway, it has been – go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, as you're bringing up offensive pass interference, another one of those plays that really affected the game would be that defensive pass interference call on Humphrey when he was going for the ball in the end zone.
That was on Kennedy, but yeah, that was another
Kennedy,
one. That was a bad one. The one on Carr, which is at the 6-yard line, I think was a pretty legitimate call.
Yeah, that one's true.
The one diving over the top on Kennedy, just a horrible call.
Any defensive pass interference when you're covering Antonio Brown, I do not mind, because it's probably the smart move at that time.
Uh-huh. Okay, I could buy that, but Kennedy shouldn't have been called. It's just one of those plays
right,
that
and that would have made that they would have then gone for the field goal and gotten 3 points instead of the touchdown.
Yep, and would have made all the difference.
Yeah, it's tough. Tony Jefferson, how'd he do? He was definitely I saw him a few times on the TV. He was making plays with Bell.
Yeah, we've talked about that a little bit earlier with Bell, so we could talk about it. What he didn't really do well in this game is Tony didn't play well on the back end. So the Ravens really exposed themselves when they wanted to play cover two for two reasons. One, you play cover two because you want to defend sideline to sideline with two levels of coverage. Okay, sometimes you even play cover three because you want to do that even more. But you play cover two because you want a man element and then also from sideline to sideline on the back end. And Jefferson just is not up for that. He doesn't recognize or read the quarterback well enough to move to the receiver that he should. And so he needs to play closer to the line of scrimmage. And he had that kind of role in Arizona last year, did not play as much on the back end, and he was a much more effective player. I think that they're going to really have to figure out how to use him at what he's more effective at for the rest of this year and going into the playoffs to get the most out of him.
All right. Let's see. We haven't gotten to Levine. He had the pass defense you mentioned.
Yeah, so that was nice to get that on a pass rush. He had a pressure. He had a sack otherwise. So very effective day for him in terms of being in the right place at the right time. He played a lot more snaps than he usually had because the Ravens played a ton of dime in this game. And not that it worked out all that well. They gave up 7.4 yards in the dime. But Levine played, let's give this a quick look here, 32 snaps, which is by far the most he's played this year. So he was very effective personally. The dime was not all that effective in whole because that's the defense they were in for those last three drives of the game when they gave up a touchdown each time, or a touchdown, field goal, I should say.
Right. Bowser got a lot of playing time, too, this week.
How exciting was that to see your
guy nice,
Bowser?
It was nice to see him get a sack, I know that.
Yeah, a sack, he had a quarterback hit, and he had 22 snaps in this game. I think he's earned more playing time. He looked good in what he did. They didn't have any runs that they ran over him with, so that was good as well. But he looked very good in his role, and he could cover as a linebacker, so it's nice to be able to drop him from the line of scrimmage and do some things with him that you can't do with just anybody. Like Za'Darius Smith, I don't really trust in coverage the same way I trust a Bowser.
Okay, so maybe in the C.J. Mosley type landscape,
well,
you think? Because they
don't
put Mosley in a bunch of coverage as well, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, Mosley's an inside linebacker, so he has to cover. But,
okay.
but with Bowser, if he's lined up opposite the tight end, which he normally would be as the Sam linebacker, then he'll have to cover a fair amount. He'll drop to cover a fair amount. And sometimes he'll rush the quarterback, and then he can be effective at that. But he has to have that combination of skills. And that's what you get from Judon, and he's played quite well this year. But Bowser I like as well, and I hope they can find a bigger role for him the rest of the way.
All right, rushing the quarterback means we got to talk about Terrell Suggs because he lives to rush on Ben Roethlisberger.
Yeah, and he didn't have a bad game. He was the Ravens' most productive pass rusher, so he had a handful of pressures. I scored him, I think, for six pressures in this game. That included the half sack, and I do not have my sheet right in front of me. I can't speak to it more than that. So that was fine. Suggs had a decent game here, but they needed somebody else to complement him in order to get a better rush going in this game. And Za'Darius Smith was the guy they really missed, but to have the Steelers go through this game and not have a holding penalty and not have a freaking turnover and not have a pass, well, they did have one, batted down at the line of scrimmage, you know, other than the Levine throw, that's not Ravens football.
Right.
Got to generate something.
Right. Now, Bell was pretty much shut down for the game, and can we single-handedly give that to Brandon Williams?
Well, Brandon Williams made a big difference in the run game coming back, and you really notice that you know, that man latching on to a running back is just – It's defeat at that point for the running back. They give up, and they're worrying about not being crushed probably a lot. But he latches on very effectively, and he looked good taking up space in this game. And the Ravens swarmed to the ball very effectively, and that included eight men really, including Jefferson in this game. So they did a very effective job against the run. And come the second half, the Steelers really gave up on it, even though they'd scored and moved the ball effectively in the first half. It was pretty much all through the air. and they gave up on the run more or less in the second half. So that was good to see, having them be able to do that, stop the Steelers' power running game, which they didn't really do too much of in this game, was one effective thing to look at for this team. The run defense is having still a fantastic run now over now what is now 6 weeks.
I see. All right, let's get to the mailbag.
Okay.
And we're going to start with one that came in a few days ago, so before the frustrating loss yesterday, which is the question from Dan Boss, who says, which is most likely, that A, the Ravens keep both Jimmy Smith and Brandon Carr next year, B, they keep Carr and they try to trade Smith, or C, they keep Smith and cut Carr, or D, they go with the young guns of Humphrey, Young, Kennedy, Hill, and spend the cap room elsewhere?
Okay, so the question is, can they really get rid of Jimmy and Carr together? They can get rid of Carr if they want to. He's a $4 million cap savings if they do it. So from a cap perspective, it's not hard to get rid of Carr if they have the bodies otherwise. He is not terribly expensive for a starting quarterback in the NFL, though. So he's a reasonable value, and if he left here, he would have other suitors. He would be somebody else would want his contract even at this level, maybe. So he might have a little trade value. If you go with the with Jimmy Smith and you ask, you know, can the Ravens get rid of him? They really can't. It would be a $13.5 million cut cap hit next year in terms of dead money if he goes, and I just don't see any world in which the Ravens are willing to do that. So Jimmy Smith will be a Raven next year. Carr, we don't know about. You know, whether or not Jimmy's able to finish the season is another question, but he's certainly going to play this next season with the Ravens.
All right. Minion Hunter asks a couple questions, all getting to the point of Humphrey looking good yesterday, and why would they not put him more on Brown, even if it's just like a shadow and some deeper help, something to put more pressure on Antonio Brown.
Okay, well, that's interesting. The Ravens play corners on each side, and Dev and I talked about this a couple weeks ago when he was on the show, but effectively, you're better off if you can stay with your own side. And people get individual cornerbacks get better at playing one side. They get more spatially acclimated to the boundary being relative to one of their shoulders. Okay, so you got corners who prefer to protect the left sideline and corners who prefer to protect the right sideline, or at least they get used to it. Now, Humphrey has actually played on both sides this year, so I don't think it would have been all that difficult to move him around and follow Brown. It just would have been a commitment there. Another possibility is you let Humphrey play on an island against the receiver on the other side, and you play just single high and get Weddle shaded to whatever side Brown is on. So that would have also been an alternative. In terms of actually shadowing one for one, very rarely have the Ravens ever done that. The Ravens have basically been a you're on this side, you're on this side team for almost all their existence. They moved McAllister around a handful of games. I want to say maybe 3-5 games in their history where they've actually had McAllister shadowing somebody. Or I can't recall it happening with Jimmy Smith, but they might have done it with Jimmy Smith on Megatron a few years ago in Detroit in 2013 is my recollection. So otherwise, it happens very infrequently, and I would not have expected it necessarily to happen in this game. I would have expected the Ravens to make other defensive adjustments to not continually let Brown burn Carr down the right sideline.
All right. Well, see, there you're jumping ahead from Mr. Ed, who asks if the Ravens have ever shadowed Antonio Brown before.
Sorry, Mr. Ed. I think we got your question then, too.
Yeah. Hickey M6 asks, what happened to the pass rush? Because last night, of course, that was the issue. When Ben had less time to throw, it led to three and outs. Was it the loss of Za'Darius Smith?
Yeah, Za'Darius Smith was a huge loss, as we said. You know, the quarterback hits he's had in recent games have led to turnovers, so it's been a big deal for that. And I can't say much else than that. I mean, they had other guys in unfamiliar roles, like Judon trying to rush from the inside, which didn't work in this game. They didn't get good inside pass rush from their second defensive lineman on the field because they're used to playing that one-down lineman set in the dime where their only lineman is Henry. So, yes, the pass rush let him down in several ways. There's a lot of reasons why, and sometimes you got to give some of the credit to the Steelers, too. Roethlisberger was very careful with the football. He made good use of his ample time and space and being very patient on routes, as he usually is. His receivers finished their routes, whereas oftentimes you get some apathetic receivers I've seen this certainly in the Ravens receivers of this year and past, where they don't finish routes, so they're not looking to run a route past 3 seconds to figure out how can they get open. So again, just something the Steelers do very well is the extended play.
It's funny, as I'm scrolling through these film study mailbag questions, it's a lot of why not help Carr?
Yeah.
So everyone was kind of wondering about that and Carr's struggles. How do you evaluate now, after a few games, Humphrey and his growth? Is he someone who you think can live up to this? JC Ball asks, do you think Humphrey's up to the task, I guess, speaking of the rest of the year?
I'm going to say without question, Humphrey's our number one quarterback, and he is one of the better number one cornerbacks in the entire league. How about that?
All right. That's exciting to have a rookie who's one of the best. Let's see. Shane Aran asks, the Steelers just ran 59 yards. Is it because of the run defense? Is this good? And how can they stop a meltdown like they did on the last drive?
Okay, so that's kind of two separate questions.
Two separate questions.
They were very effective versus the run, and I think we talked a little bit about that. Brandon Williams came back, and if he did not always penetrate, he brought the threat of penetration with his presence that told the Steelers, we can't play this power run game moving from right to left, generally speaking, with DeCastro and oftentimes a tight end pulling from right to left. That just was ridiculously effective the first game, and it was largely due to a failure of inside penetration. We talked about it last year with Jeremy Zuda as the one player I want to get back to, is when he gave up penetration, he precluded a lot of the pulling that the Ravens could have done because he would give up ground. And that happens at guard as well, and Williams, being a three tech, is typically over a guard and has a chance to push the guard back on that side. And that the threat of that, if not the actuality of that, is something that made it very uncomfortable for the Steelers to do that. Plus, they were having a lot of success throwing the ball, so they said, why stop doing that?
All right.
I'm sorry, there was another question in there, and I've missed it.
The other question was
meltdown fourth quarter.
The meltdown. How do you avoid that meltdown?
Okay. So I think one of the ways you can do it is not give them the ball back. But once you're in that situation, I think the most important thing from a game management perspective, from Harbaugh's perspective, frankly, is to realize you're not in Kansas anymore. You're in a different place where you can't rely on your defense because they're not up to it. If you look, all you got to do is look on the sideline over your shoulder and see that there's all these guys breathing very heavily, having difficulty catching their breath, and you ought to realize, I can't put these guys back on the field. I got to try and take a shot on fourth and three here, or I got to try and run the ball twice when it's third and three. So anyway, I think that the realization of that and the changes are difficult for a lot of coaches to make. They don't want to take heat, clearly, like Belichick did a few years ago for going for it on fourth and two and failing. So they don't want to entertain the notion that might be the right idea. But in point of fact, that drive on offense was the Ravens' big chance to win this game. They really were not ahead in the game, being 2 points up, if they were going to give the ball back to the Steelers. They were trailing. That's the way they have to look at it. So they had to make a first down. In fact, they probably had to make a couple of first downs to keep their defense off the field and have a real reasonable chance to win that game.
Okay. I'm going to combine a couple Twitter comments because they're all the same. Speaking of C.J. Mosley, so I'm going to cover Milan and Ola with giving you a chance to talk about C.J. Mosley. And we referenced that he's slow and he seems to have been struggling this year. Meanwhile, he seems to be the only guy we have for an inside linebacker for the future. Is this a guy that we're going to have to extend his contract? Should we be concerned about this guy?
Okay, I am concerned about C.J. Mosley in the sense that he's hurt now and he might not be 100% to go the rest of the year, including the playoffs. That's a major concern. I'm not as concerned about Mosley next year. I think he'll be back. He'll be a linebacker, will be the defensive signal caller for sure. Whether the Ravens tie him up long-term now or they have him play just under the fifth-year option. They see where this goes. They've got a couple of different ways they can look at it for 2018. But one thing they're going to have to do is draft another inside linebacker. And that would be true no matter what, because they have no depth at inside linebacker. In fact, their second inside linebacker is really the weakness of the team. So they've got to find a way to strengthen that position, if for no other reason, even if they're convinced Peanut can continue to play okay. And he's not been playing bad, but it's just he's not up to the standard of the rest of this defense. If they got a second inside linebacker who could really play, it would actually provide them depth so that every time C.J. Mosley is on the ground, we're not holding our breath waiting for him to get up.
All right. I'm going to again combine some comments that came in about kidnapping Dean Pease and everything, and instead I'm going to form it as a question of what do we take of Dean Pease this year? Do we like how he's been calling the games? Is there a problem with Dean Pease? We all agree that there's probably a problem with Marty Morningweg, even though the offense is starting to get some steam. Now that the defense is falling apart in some big opportunities, what do we take of Dean Pease?
Well, this is really the first time the defense has fallen apart and cost them a game, as the way I look at it. I mean, they had Brandon Williams out for a while, and they lost a couple games when he wasn't there providing that enormous presence in the middle. And they lost some games to some teams that are pretty good. They lost to Jacksonville and London without Williams, and then Jacksonville ended up being Jacksonville, who's a good team. So, you know, that's not that terrible. Generally speaking, I am positive on Dean Pease. He discovered the dime this year after 5 years of ignoring it when it was the best option. One thing a friend and I often say is, I hate having to wait for circumstances to conspire for a coach to do the right thing. And this was one of these cases with the dime defense that it was the right answer all along, and it's only because you've got Patrick Owosso and you've got Kamala Correa as your options in inside linebacker that you're finally putting on the field on third down. And then, you know, Levine is not only, you know, one of your best defensive specialists, you know, he's a playmaker too. I mean, he's done all kinds of positive things for the Ravens this year. And they've got a second guy, Chuck Clark, who's getting snaps there as well. So anyway, my point is that I think he should probably have recognized that the dime was a better option sooner, but he's there now. He's called a good defensive game plan, I think, for the year. He's shown just enough out of the playbook to get by week after week and to do the right things. I think he's blitzed quarterbacks who were inexperienced, who would have given trouble, and he's blitzed when he's had to in games like this, even where there was a lot of risk involved because he had no other way to get pressure on the quarterback. So I think from that standpoint, I like the way he's run the game. In general, that's my feeling about Dean. It's not going to upset me tremendously if he retires, but I hope the Ravens will use the opportunity, to hire a revolutionary defensive coordinator and not an old school defensive coordinator. And it will also not upset me if Dean is back next year. He's done like a creditable job. You know, he's getting older. He'll be, I guess, 69 years old next year. So there is a question as to whether he'll continue anyway. But Dean Pease is not the problem this year with the defense.
Right. And the exciting thing is that the Ravens do have a history of bringing in those revolutionary defensive coordinators like a Marvin Lewis and Rex Ryan.
That's right. Lewis, Ryan, and even Nolan. You know, right. Nolan was the most old school of the three, but all of them were aggressive dime defense players who loved to blitz with their dime and loved to do things with extra defensive backs on the field. That's the Ravens tradition, and I would love for that to be maintained, but extended in some different way with a new coordinator.
All right. Jacob Rock asks a good question for us to finish this mailbag segment with, and it's a two-parter. The first one part we'll get to in a second, but the second part of this question was asking about the ball fumbling out of bounds, which we will get to in the offensive episode in a couple of days. But his question was more of like, did you know about that rule? Because the Ravens sure looked confused about that rule.
Right. They look confused about the rule. It did not come to my mind as it was happening, so it's hardly something I can blame the Ravens for not realizing. Had they known, it would have been difficult for them to get over center and have a play called and get the ball to the sideline and, you know, get somebody out of bounds, or even to spike it, which would have just given them then probably a Hail Mary opportunity as their only option. Their big chance, they had to get it within the previous two plays.
Right. And
throw down. Yeah,
the Macklin injury timeout is what really hurt that final drive.
You know, you were right on the money.
But
tough
then,
game for Macklin.
Yeah, but then Jacob Rock asks, How do the Ravens walk away from this game? Should they be discouraged or encouraged with the good offense and for keeping the game close to a good game, a team like the Steelers? And what should the Ravens take away from this be?
Well, it's a good question, Jacob, and I think, you know, it's good that you're able to see the glasses half full or as half empty. I look at it and I see plenty of positive. I do see negative in this. I think, you know, they got their pants pulled down in terms of what their secondary can do in this game a little bit. But on the other side, they really did have a very good offensive showing. And if I'm looking at this team and I'm saying, how can they improve most, it's not by marginal arithmetic increases on defense. Those are going to be small. If Flacco is all of a sudden healthy, that has a geometric impact on the rest of the offense. All things are easier if Joe is healthy. All things are easier if Alex Collins is breaking tackles the way he did in this game. It's just there was a lot to be excited about offensively about what they did in this game. And sure, they've got weaknesses, and it's Joe Flacco was able to hit some receivers that hadn't been part of the offense before. Moore had not done too much for this team. I saw in this game Joe Flacco going outside the numbers with the fastball the way he used to as a rookie, and the way that used to be a good part of the offensive game plan, these 8 and 10 yard outs. I would love for that to be back. It's a great play. I would love to see the offensive line continue to be able to get some decent level two opportunities for Alex Collins. He's broken tackles like crazy, 10 missed tackles according to PFF by Collins in this game, and he had an average length after contact, average distance traveled after contact of 5.28 yards per this game, according to PFF. Think about just how ridiculously high that is. More than 5 yards after contact per touch. So, anyway.
Yeah, I saw today. For one, I think it's funny if you asked anyone, there's no one in the world who would have picked in July that Alex Collins and Chris Moore would be stars for the Ravens this year.
No, that's true.
Especially Alex Collins wasn't even with the organization at the time. But Chris Moore's total yardage for this year is what Antonio Brown had last night.
So that sounds about right.
Right. So my question for you to close out the mailbag with a question for me is, do we get a third Ravens-Steelers game this year?
I think the chance is reasonably high, and the best chance for it is if the Steelers take care of New England in Pittsburgh, which I think is a reasonable possibility. So if that happens, then the Ravens are in as the six, then yeah, there's a good chance it's the Ravens and Steelers after the Ravens
go on the road.
Yeah, it'll be the divisional round. So it would depend on the Ravens obviously winning a game.
Right.
They'd probably have a 30% chance to do so, or perhaps a little bit more on the road against the Chiefs, or probably actually be in Tennessee or in Jacksonville. I still think they're a 30% chance to win even a game like that. So, you know, you're gonna have to face somebody good when you're in the playoffs.
Sure.
But honestly, I think that they are much better suited to beat Jacksonville now than they were in week 4 when they went there.
Well, and
week three.
I'd much rather travel to Jacksonville than to London.
To London, yes, sir.
All right. Can you mention a couple articles up on Russell Street Report?
Yeah, I appreciate you mentioning that. So we got an article on the defense today. We'll have an article on the playoff situation tomorrow. And there's a nice set of pass rush event by event out there. I just noticed there was something wrong with it that I need to fix, but we will be able to get that fixed and get it out there tomorrow, so you can review kind of play by play what we're talking about in terms of when do they get pressure and when do they not. If you want to go back to your game pass and look at that, you'll have that. Follow me on Twitter at Film Study Ravens. Appreciating the conversation during the day. Apologize to some of the fans that I can't respond always during the day on Monday. If you hit me up on other days, it's usually much better. I'm very active during the day on Twitter, but Monday is particularly after a Sunday night game, is a writing day, and apologize for not being as quick to respond today. How about your show, Josh?
My show, Section 336. We come out a new podcast every Monday night. So a little later tonight, we'll be recording a new 336. And we're going to talk about, on the Ravens side of the ball, we're going to talk about, I want to bring up the question about this team. And is it fair that we always compare the Ravens defense to the Ravens defense of Ray Lewis, Ed Reed, Haloti Ngata, Terrell Suggs, when that's a team of Hall of Famers? And is it fair that that is who we always compare the Ravens to? Or is that's clearly a once in a lifetime team. You never have that ever again. But as fans, we constantly compare it to those years.
Right.
And then on the baseball side, we've got to get into the Orioles stuff because there's been lots of Dan Duquette talk this week. As the winter meeting started today, there's some rumors that the Orioles are interested in Matt Harvey from the Mets.
Huh. I've not heard that.
Yeah, he was a good pitcher a few years ago. He's been banged up since, so he sounds like he's right in the Orioles
He's been through the Tommy John program, right?
Exactly,
already?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, so we're going to talk about that as well as why we don't play the international market as far as the Orioles and the fact that we still only have two starters in our rotation right now, and how are we going to address that?
That is a lengthy topic. I would think that's more than 30 minutes right there.
Yeah, the show will definitely be an hour tonight, maybe a little over an hour, I would imagine.
Okay. So. Now, one of the things I like about Josh's podcast, and you guys will take a listen, I hope, is that with the nice commercial-free nature of these podcasts, you get dense talk from local fans who are really interested, and you know, we appreciate the great questions on this show, and I think you'll get the same from Josh's in terms of having really good, opinionated people there at the table to talk about it. And it's a good local sports podcast and one that doesn't mess around and doesn't pull punches.
Thank you, Ken. Well, we will talk about the offense because that was the exciting side of the ball. So let's talk about them in like 2 days.
Life's good, Josh. All talk right. to you then.
Bye.